Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, back at you to examine one of the more perplexing mysteries to come out of England in recent times, which is the disappearance of 14-year-old Andrew Gosden. On the morning of September 14th, 2007, the teen left his Balby home and boarded a train departing the Doncaster Railway Station. Soon after, he arrived at King's Cross Station in London and was captured on surveillance video as he prepared to leave the premises. But Andrew's ultimate destination was unknown. And tragically, that's the last time there's a confirmed sighting of him. In more than 12 years since that event, not one shred of evidence has come to light to suggest what might have been the fate of Andrew Gosden. Many theories arose in the aftermath of the disappearance, yet none has been lent legitimacy by way of fact. The authorities, Andrew's family, and the general public are all left baffled, ignorant, and hoping for the mercy of a lead suddenly coming to fruition. Was Andrew simply skipping school and wanted the excitement of a day away from the mundane grind of attending classes and doing related work? Was there a concert or perhaps another event in London that day Andrew wanted to attend, but for which he believed his parents wouldn't allow him, thereby making forgiveness after the fact a better option than seeking permission beforehand? Was Andrew depressed, even suicidal, and sought the anonymity of the big city as a means of concealing the shame of his act from his family and others? Or was the teen groomed by an adult, some sort of sexual predator, and succumbed in his ignorance upon arriving in London and getting caught in a web? Now, I should mention right up front that I don't see a rational narrative present in this story, meaning I don't think Andrew's desires, intentions, and actions form a cohesive physical sequence that allows the disappearance to be solved by way of examining his movements. I believe this is a case of emotional desperation manifesting in physical action intended as a coping mechanism in lieu of a solution. The facts of the case have been dissected a million times over, and they lead nowhere. I think that mystery is a product of a lack of rational motive on Andrew's part. We don't always plan. We don't always have solid reasons for what we do. Sometimes we just run to get away, to try to escape the feelings inside. That's what we do. When we're being chased and refuse to fight, we run. I believe this is a mystery that requires emotional exploration rather than physical examination. The answers aren't in the details. They're in Andrew's head. The police didn't do a very good job piecing this crime together with any type of urgency, and therefore, while the case could have been greatly assisted by additional security footage from locations leading away from the King's Cross Station, that didn't happen. In addition, Andrew left no clues as to where he might be headed. There's no trail of communication between him and another person. He didn't tell any friends at school, nor had he been communicating with the sexual predator, as far as anyone could tell. His vanishing remains a mystery. So let's backtrack to the days leading up to the disappearance and see what clues we can extract from the underlying psychology inherent in Andrew's actions, as well as his overall disposition as described by family and friends. Now, just a little bit about the person. Andrew, again, is 14 years old and stands 5 feet 3 inches tall and has a slim build. While he's not very big, this stature is by no means unusually small for somebody his age. However, Andrew was known for having a baby face, which often made him appear as though he might be as young as 12. All of which is to say, Andrew clearly looked like a boy and was not someone who'd be mistaken as a young man due to his impressive physical maturity. For instance, Johnny Gosch was 5 feet 8 inches at 12 years old, 2 years younger than Andrew. Andrew wore glasses and had longer hair you'd expect to find on a kid who likes heavy metal music. On that note, that was exactly his taste in music. Andrew, when out of school, was the type of person to wear mostly black t-shirts representing his favorite bands, along with jeans. The day he disappeared, He was wearing a black Slipknot t-shirt with a large design on the front, in addition to lighter black jeans. Andrew was also an exceptionally bright kid who excelled in school, earning outstanding grades and exhibiting a strong sense of work ethic, along with nearly perfect attendance. He often participated in programs geared toward gifted students, and the word genius found itself in the same sentence with him as a descriptor. Andrew's specialty was mathematics and anything related, and he displayed an introverted, almost withdrawn disposition common to certain genius intellects. Basically, he was a quiet, shy intellectual type who preferred video games to flirting and listening to others speak rather than running his mouth. Andrew was said to have been quite introspective as well, offering words for his feelings only on the rare occasion they would mean something. That's pretty typical of introverted people. Small talk can be difficult, even painful to endure. He had a modestly sized group of friends, but was said to mostly socialize with them at school, preferring the isolation of his bedroom at home, or the furnished basement where he loved to play his Xbox. He didn't keep a regular social calendar like most kids his age. It seemed he had a more mature, sophisticated mind, better suited to his own company than anybody else's. It's clear to me that he has what many of us would describe as an old soul. He was 14, but seemed 40 in terms of his emotional predisposition. At a time when most kids are dependent upon their social lives to forge any type of identity, Andrew seemed to shun that notion. Most kids are desperate for more connection to the outside world, but Andrew seemed to be committed to a plight that was antithetical to the norm. His parents even gave him a cell phone, which you'd think any 14-year-old kid would desperately desire to have. But Andrew ignored it to an extent he didn't even want it anymore and finally gave it back. Apparently, he didn't use it, nor did he anticipate he would. In addition, the family didn't even have a computer at home. About 2 months prior to the disappearance, Andrew's mother obtained some type of laptop, which means there was a computer in the house for a short time before the vanishing, but there's no evidence to suggest that Andrew used it in any way that might lead us to learn his intended destination, or was even communicating with a predator. All of which is to say that, right up front, we have no electronic trail of Andrew's stated intentions, nor do we have surveillance leading away from King's Cross Station. That doesn't give us much to work with. Now, let's talk about Andrew's home life for a minute. Andrew's parents are devout Christians, but decided that they wouldn't raise their kids with their own beliefs, preferring instead to allow the children to make these decisions for themselves as their desire for faith, or lack thereof, developed over the years. Of course, you can judge that in whatever way you like, but what's apparent, regardless of our feelings about it, is that the parents have afforded them one thing: autonomy. That's not something you find in an abusive household, unless it comes as a product of neglect, meaning kids do whatever they want because they're being ignored. That wasn't the case here. So Andrew wasn't reeling from abuse. He had access to video games and TV. His parents tried to give him a cell phone. This wasn't an oppressive environment, at least not directly. So we don't see any signs of Andrew lashing out at school either. He isn't doing awful things to get attention. Basically, it seems as though Andrew came from a decent home with loving parents. But whether he intended to leave for a day or forever, he was running. And what we need to ask in order to have a better idea where he went is this: why? Why did Andrew Gosden skip school that day and get on a train headed to London? Not just the surface level reason. We need to go beneath that, into the bedrock of his emotions. So, I think we have to look at this situation not only in the context of probability, but also within the framework of the psychology present in Andrew's actions. Now, again, let's talk a little bit more about the person. Andrew preferred to play Xbox at home, by himself, to socializing outside of the home with friends. It's a self-imposed isolation, typical of the introvert, one that has as many benefits as flaws. Introverts will often deeply indulge their own interests and might even gain mastery of something by way of the time spent in isolation. On the other hand, as alluring as the isolation can be, it also generally leads to equivalent loneliness at some point. And when it happens, one can either venture out into the world or hide. Andrew reportedly spent time with his family, did his schoolwork, and enjoyed things like puzzles, video games, and music. He was not outwardly depressed and hadn't spoke of any type of mental illness, even depression. Of course, he might have been suffering from any combination of things, but if so, he hid the truth. Andrew seems a gentle person. We don't have reports of him exploding in rage. He seems to have not been a behavioral problem at home or even in school. Excellent grades, regular attendance, those aren't things that scream depression or suicide. But they could have been a facade. He could have been desperately trying to prevent a crack in the dam from bursting. But when the floodwaters came crashing through the wall he built, he drowned. That could have happened. So let's try to get to the heart of the truth. I'm going to offer what I see in Andrew. I think a great place to start is his music. Why does Andrew listen to heavy metal? Here's what I think, as a kid who also wore those band t-shirts and listened to loud heavy music when I was 14. I did it because I had rage in my heart and needed to express that through indulging art conducive to offering that type of catharsis. Music that's full of rage is designed to release the rage from you. The music is an expression of rage, and your reaction to it might be anything from playing air guitar and banging your head to punching people in a mosh pit at a concert. But the point is that it's like theme music for your life. That's the point of the black band t-shirts common to heavy metal. They advertise your brand of rage. As a teen, you don't have a career or kids of your own yet, so you don't have the ability to enjoy a fully formed identity outside of being a student and participating in school activities. You haven't defined yourself like your elders. And so there's meaning in the music. If there's rage in your heart, then there's very likely going to be rage coming from your headphones. When you meet someone like you who likes this type of music, the bond goes beyond the band and the songs themselves. It transcends those things as part of an unspoken commonality that silently whispers the two of you are cut from the same cloth, and know that, in some way, there's something going on at home, even if it's just in your head, that you can't control, and causes you a lot of anger. Here's a great example. I met a close friend in 7th grade because both of us got started talking one day over the fact we were wearing Metallica t-shirts. We quickly became friends, and what was apparent to me is that we were both not especially enraged in an outward manner. He seemed very friendly, polite, and nonviolent, and I tended to emulate the same. But at home, my mother's alcoholism and its ensuing spread through the psyche of our family, like a disease, left me feeling hopeless. And because I was hopeless, I was angry. So, when I chose music that empowered me, it would be full of rage. My friend seemed to have a normal family life, in a good home. But I knew all I had to do was observe him for a while to see the truth. All the kids who listened to that music and dressed like that at the age of 14 had some type of problem at home, in their heads, or both, no matter how severe or mild. In my friend's case, I quickly learned he had an overbearing mother who drove him crazy, and being 14 and desiring more independence, she was like a ball and chain attached to his leg during a time when he wanted to fly. And it's not like he was being abused. He just couldn't breathe at all. And he was angry knowing he'd have to exist in that environment until at least the time he turns 18. His sister's way of dealing with it was becoming a goth. She expressed it that way. Kids have different ways of dealing with these things. But one thing is always true. They look for others like them. Yet, Andrew doesn't seem to have been doing that. There's no report of him going out with friends who emulated the same style. He might have hung out with a few people at school, but he didn't have a social life. And we have to ask why. The degree of introversion he's exhibiting is more typical of an adult. As kids, even the unpopular people hang out with each other. When you're young, you normally have lots of free time, fewer commitments, and less inhibition about meeting new people. But Andrew kept to himself. I'm certainly not suggesting he would have been the alpha male at school had he asserted himself, but the impression we get about him is that he wasn't hopeless. He did interact with other people at school on a regular basis. He had some friends there. Now, what we know, or what we see, is that Andrew's rage was not outwardly apparent. His mother and father don't seem to have leaned on him to a point he went over a cliff. Neither of those two is reported to have been abusive in any way, either directly or indirectly, physically or emotionally. I think the fact that Andrew did really well in school, always attended, and displayed quite a bit of potential speaks to the likelihood his home life was pretty much as offered to us on the surface. He seems to have had some autonomy. He was allowed to hole up in his bedroom if he chose, and also sit down in the basement playing video games. If you were his parents, why not, right? He's gifted and hardworking. He seems fine. They're even going to let him choose his faith. They aren't forcing theirs on him. It doesn't sound like an environment in which a teen needed to bother to rebel. That is, unless the thing he wants is unavailable or unacceptable in his household. Now, if you look at his age, 14, that's basically the bullseye on puberty for a male. Some go through changes earlier, and some later. But in approximate terms, the age of 14 is the year when a male teen's sexuality begins to spiral out of control. Now, like I said, if the root of the darkness in his music can't be found in his home, then it must be in his heart, and by extension, his head. Something hurts inside. We know there is rage, and we know it doesn't seem to come from his home directly. But it still has to be attached to his home, even indirectly, to become valid. His home has to be part of what's stopping him, or at least the people in it. In this case, since it's his parents' house and his parents' rules, we assume it's them. So, there's something he wants to do on a social level, but doesn't feel like he can do it in the framework of a life being lived at his parents' house. Again, let's look at who Andrew seems to be in this story. He's not violent, outwardly angry, threatening, depressed, apathetic, bipolar, or anything of the sort. But we know there was a problem. So let's combine the elements present to find the truth. The choice of music equals rage. The source of it is not in the home. It's in Andrew's head and heart, though indirectly affects his home life. So, where is he going to have to venture if he wants to indulge the thing he can't do at his parents' house? Or feels like he can't do at his parents' house? The answer, of course, is outside it. And if he's unwilling to tell his parents, yet also unwilling to tell his classmates of his intentions, or school friends, so to speak, then what's the secret? What does he want to do that involves excluding people from school, up to and including all of them, in addition to his parents, resulting in total secrecy? Well, we haven't inserted sexuality into our narrative yet, and that's where I think we get our answer. Some of Andrew's classmates have asserted it was apparent to them that Andrew was gay. Of course, he hadn't told them that, so it isn't a fact, but when his parents were faced with the possibility, they didn't refute it. In fact, they said if Andrew is still out there, they want him to know they don't care that his sexuality potentially violates their Christian beliefs. They just want to know he's okay. Of course, they have to wonder if their beliefs indirectly played a role. Was Andrew's self-imposed social isolation outside of school a result of trying to cope with the fact that he was unable to come to terms with his burgeoning sexuality while inhabiting a home shared with parents who might not accept him? Is it possible he withheld the secret and in the process allowed himself to become plagued by worry and self-doubt before ever bringing the subject to light? At 14 years old, regardless of your level of maturity afforded by a gifted intellect, it's beyond difficult to tell your parents you're gay and then ask if, and even how, you'll be accepted in the aftermath of this revelation. There's risk involved. If that interaction doesn't go as planned, lives could be changed forever in the process, at least in terms of those relationships. But, again, it could also go very well. And we get the sense here that Andrew's desire was to keep whatever secret led him astray September 14th, 2007. Nobody at school knew. Nobody at home knew. And he disappeared with that knowledge. So what I gather from this is Andrew, in some form or another, went looking for the thing he desired to keep a secret. And tragically, with the greatest of irony, that secret remains hidden to this day. I think he went looking for something, most likely defined as this: somebody like himself. Somebody who finally understood what it was like to hide. And he found that person in the worst way possible, in the form of a sexual predator. I don't think Andrew went out looking for sex. I think he went desperately into an ocean of people to find a new friend. And it killed him. Because sharks always know one thing. Their prey is searching for something too. Knowing that secret, seeing it in a victim's eyes, is what allows them to gain trust. I'll give you an example of what I mean. I'm not sure if I've mentioned this story on the show. I always forget. Anyhow, in my senior year of high school, I cut school one day with a small group of friends. I think there were about 7 of us. We lived in Philly at the time and drove up to New York to visit Manhattan for the day. As we were walking through Times Square, a van pulled up next to us and we saw it was truancy officers with the police. We knew we were going to get caught, but nobody ran because it just wasn't the worst thing to ever happen. None of our parents would be proud, of course, but most of us had parents who would get a little mad and perhaps even ground us for a couple of days, but also understood we were seniors just trying to have some fun before we graduated. On the other hand, we had one friend in the group whose parents would have had a terribly negative reaction and would have behaved as though it was the end of the world. And he feared that, of course. He understood it to be true. So whereas the rest of us just basically said, "Okay, you got me," this one guy in the group quickly slipped behind the van and ran across the street before the cops could get a head count on us. So the rest of us got in a van and we were driven to a local school, separated from our friend. Meanwhile, we're all wondering what the hell is going to become of him. And this is the point of how it relates to Andrew Gosden. The kids in my group who got picked up by the cops were less sheltered than the others, and our parents knew there were risks, and conversely, benefits associated with that type of thing. They knew we were street smart enough to take a trip like this, and because they'd always let us be adventurous, we could return home knowing the punishment would be light. But look what problem is created for the sheltered kid. He was desperate to not get caught, but in the process of doing so, he exposes himself to this huge city without his friends and in the absence of street smarts. The rest of us would know how to react to a situation like that, but he didn't. So what happens is that he appears to predators to be exactly what he looks like: a kid with no clue who needs help finding his way home. So, how do you lure him? You be the thing he needs. That's all. It took a predator seconds to find my friend. I'm not joking. He got scammed in mere seconds and found himself in a very bad spot. He needed a friend. He needed someone to understand. And he got that in the worst way possible. A man who claimed his name was Tony approached him and said he saw what happened. He said he not only knew people who could help reunite my buddy with the rest of his friends, but could also get him to a phone he could use. So he follows this guy into a nearby Chinese restaurant, and the man tells him the phone is down in the basement. And my friend just blindly follows, not questioning this path. They go down to the basement, and he tells my friend to sit in a chair. So the kid does. My buddy asks to use the phone, but doesn't see one anywhere. Tony just stands there, looming over him in silence. Finally, he demands my friend's wallet and removes a knife from his jacket. He puts it to the kid's face and says to hurry. My friend gives up the wallet, and Tony stands there staring, knife still pointed. He suddenly asks a question. Why the hell did you think the phone was down here? It's a fucking Chinese restaurant. How do you think they take orders upstairs? And my friend is in shock. He doesn't answer at first. But then he says this. I guess I trusted you. And the man replies, but you didn't want to, did you? And my friend shakes his head no. He didn't want to trust Tony. Not one bit. So naturally, Tony asks a very revealing question. He wonders, so why did you? Why did you trust me? My friend sits there looking stupid for a moment. And then a light bulb goes on. He says, because I had to. And Tony clarifies for him. He says, no, you didn't have to. You put yourself in a situation that left you with no other choice. You shouldn't have come here, kid. So Tony stares with these wild eyes and then tells my buddy to get the hell out. He keeps the wallet and its content, of course, but my friend gets away with a lesson. Since that day, I've wondered how many times Tony did that same thing when the truancy police rolled through Times Square. He must have picked these kids off one by one. But my friend walked away, having learned a lesson, because Tony simply wanted to rob him. If Tony wanted sex, we'd have never seen him again. And that's essentially what I see in the case of Andrew Gosden. I think this desperate kid went looking for a friend like him, likely with romantic intentions involved, but not with the immediate goal of sex. And somebody saw that in him, a sexual predator. My friend might have been desperate in his actions in the story, but just consider how much worse it is involving love and or sexuality. All my friend wanted to do was get home. You can take a wallet and let somebody go, but sex crimes perpetrated against kids by strangers can often lead to murder. To negate the consequences. In no other facet of life are we as gullible, desperate, and vulnerable as we are when it comes to searching for love and sex. Predators know that, and like the vampire, seek to feed from your point of weakness, as access to what they seek is found more easily this way. A vampire feeds from your neck, which offers a great concentration of easily accessible blood flow by way of the carotid arteries and jugular vein. So in the same way we profile a criminal, such as a serial killer, psychopath, or sociopath, let's now take a trip to the other side of the equation and take the POV of a creep. How does the vampire locate potential victims? We know he has sharp fangs and can bite. But how does he secure proximity to his target? How does he gain trust? The vampire gains trust through the allure of immortality, which equates to making the pain go away forever. That's what we all want the most, for the pain to subside, allowing us peace both physically and emotionally. So when a vampire approaches, he offers that facade. Vampires, regardless of what rules they live by in the world in which they were created, are known for being synonymous with seduction. But what don't they do? They don't feel. They don't sympathize with you. They're looking to feed. That's the sexual predator. They know what you want because most often, like the vampire, what they're planning to do to you is what somebody already did to them in the past and in the context of a lie promising to make the pain go away. They will then perpetrate the same lie upon you for the emotional equivalent of revenge and, as was done to them, physically feed upon your desire for a cure. So as the vampire, let's just say we're walking down the street, whether actively looking for a victim at the time, or even just happening upon a circumstance of running into prospective prey. What facade would you offer a potential target? The answer to this question, and in any area of life, is to be what people want. That notion has two considerations. There are things we want to acquire, meaning items or circumstances extraneous to our person, such as beautiful significant others, a large home, a fast car, or whatever the case might be. And then there is also the consideration of what we want to become. For instance, if I'm 7 years old and I play t-ball, then one day, good old dad takes me to a big league game and I meet a star player, I'm going to look up to whomever that is. He understands what I want and can offer guidance in getting to that place in life. So if he offers advice, I'm going to trust that it's genuine, even if I don't know him. Of course, the ball player has no reason to lie to the kid. He was once that kid too, and so generally seeks to offer legitimate advice conducive to the kid succeeding, and likely because someone did it for him too. I mean, he has nothing to offer by lying. He's a millionaire. He's not attracted to children. He doesn't mean any harm. So there's no incentive to utilize deception. Yet notice that you still do the same thing that somebody did to you, only, in this case, in a positive manner. But if you're a sexual predator, specifically someone who seeks to have physical relations with immature underage boys like Andrew, then you're forced to hide. You have no choice but to be the vampire. You can't operate out in the sunlight. You must keep your secrets veiled within darkness. Yet, where the problem comes in is that, like the kid meeting the baseball player, the victim of the sexual predator also believes the advice he's getting. All the vampire has to do is feign sympathy. And abusers usually do that so well because, at some point, in the past, they were the victim as well. So, how do you feign sympathy? Well, pedophiles are obviously attracted to people much younger than themselves, and therefore can approach under the guise of a mentor. So, let's say I'm Andrew Gosden, and I realize I'm gay, but I'm struggling with the implications as it pertains to the rest of my life. How will I be viewed at school? How will my parents react? Will there be consequences? Considerations like this build anxiety. And what that confused person needs is reassurance. He can't get it from his parents without divulging the secret. He can't get it at school for similar reasons. He's feeling alone, left out on an island. Isolation hasn't worked to cure his ills. But the one place he can find advice on the matter is from someone who's been through it already. Somebody older. Someone who comes to him as a mentor. Yet, how would that happen? I'll give you an example of how this transpires. We have all gone to a public place with wild desires in mind that would seem foolish if spoken aloud, like going to a coffee shop thinking you might fall in love. We fantasize about crossing paths with certain people, getting the courage to approach them, or hoping they'll approach us. But it's all done in service of one thing. We're seeking someone who understands. We want to fix the thing that hurts us. But sometimes those things are irreconcilable with the lives we have to lead. And so, instead of seeking to be fixed, we begin to accept our circumstances and instead desire understanding. If change is not possible, sympathy helps to cope. If you work in an office, this might be as simple as heading out for a coffee break and trash-talking your boss with a coworker who knows the same pain of dealing with that person. If you have a drug addiction and have stopped using but still feel the urges moving forward on a regular basis, then rather than trying to fix the fact that you have those urges, you would seek others who experience them as well. Sympathy and empathy are emotional placeholders for that which is irreconcilable by nature and or circumstance. If your loved one dies, I can offer you empathy. If you're afflicted by something that's affected my life too, I can offer you sympathy. Either way, it's an extension of saying you understand and care. Now, let's say Andrew Gosden is in fact gay, as the rumors suggest. His parents can't sympathize, and he's afraid they won't empathize due to their religious beliefs. Andrew is also afraid to come out at school because it's terrifying. He doesn't know what the consequences will be, except that it will be too late to take back his admission if anything goes wrong. So look what's missing here. Advice. Andrew doesn't know how to proceed, but he does know social isolation isn't working, especially in light of his adolescence causing the emergence of sexuality within his desires at age 14. He doesn't have anyone he can talk to about it. And look what that says at its core. Andrew doesn't have anyone he can trust. At least, not with this issue. So he has to find somebody. That person isn't at home, nor is that person at school. The risk is too great. He could be exposed. But if he left the confines of his usual circumstances and tried something new, he might get different results. The problem is that he isn't looking to make new friends in a traditional sense. He's looking for someone to trust in relation to his sexuality. Most 14-year-olds aren't going to breach the subject of sexuality in a sophisticated manner, lending itself to greater psychological awareness of truth. The type of answers Andrew would be seeking, in such a circumstance, are the type you'd receive from someone who's already been through what you're experiencing. And that brand of sympathy is far more likely to come from adults. That's a dangerous way to go because pedophiles are fully aware of this truth. So again, let's put ourselves in the shoes of a creep and examine what he would see when viewing Andrew Gosden. It's an emotional puzzle that's fairly simple to assemble. Let's say Andrew is on the street looking into a storefront window at a shop, and a pedophile who is either on the prowl or just happens to be passing sees him there. He knows it's a school day, and Andrew is clearly in that age group, so there's obviously a reason he's not in school. As a general practice, parents don't normally allow their 14-year-old kids to cut school and wander the city streets instead, so one would assume, upon seeing Andrew, given that he's alone, that he has chosen to avoid school of his own volition, as it's clear he isn't on a field trip with other students. Now, there are plenty of reasons a group of kids might want to cut school, such as attending a sporting event, having a party at a friend's house while their parents are at work, or even just like my buddies and I tried to do in New York, sometimes you just intend to get away from the mundane reality of your own life and explore all the city offers. But look what happened. When we cut school and went to Manhattan as a group, the group ended up being picked up by the truancy cops. It's not like a pedophile was going to come along and wrangle seven of us into a van. Yet, let's remember what happened to the guy who escaped the circumstance and ended up alone. he got approached by a criminal and fell victim because being alone caused him to be more vulnerable. When a creep sees you alone, you offer the greatest level of vulnerability, both physically and emotionally. So in the same way my friend ended up alone on the streets and needed someone to help him, leading him to succumb to a predator by way of desperation, Andrew easily could have experienced something similar. Andrew is alone in the city for a reason. He's looking for the thing that's missing, just like my friend was looking for a phone to find a way to get him back home. So, if you're the creep and see Andrew, you realize he's likely cut school in favor of being alone. Something is wrong. He needed to get away and be alone. Now, what is wrong? The creep asks that and sees the all-black clothing ensemble highlighted by the Slipknot t-shirt. So the creep knows this kid has some type of rage going on inside his heart and mind. That's the thing bothering the kid. It's emotional. It's what he wants to cure. Knowing that, the creep has to become that thing. He needs to relate to the pain. And if Andrew's classmates felt that he was likely gay, and his parents didn't object to the notion, then what this pedophile is likely going to do is take on the role of someone who overcame what Andrew is facing. A mentor, a friend, but only on the surface. He's just using the emotional vulnerability he's being afforded to get his potential victim to take the necessary actions in order to fall into a trap that he's set. Without question, a kid alone in the city on a school day is both running from something and searching for something else. The predator needs to identify with why Andrew ran in the first place, in addition to representing a mentor who has overcome the issue himself. That's how a stranger will gain trust with a 14-year-old he wants to lure. Now, again, we don't know that this is what happened. So let's go through the timeline of events here, leading up to the disappearance, and round out a theory from there. As stated earlier, we don't have so much as one shred of evidence that Andrew had been groomed by anyone, or had even been in contact with a potential predator. On top of that, he had limited access to computers and was said to not even have an email address. Most of his time was spent either at school or at home playing video games, hanging out with his family, and doing homework. That type of a lifestyle is a low-risk situation for the involvement of a predator. I don't believe Andrew was being groomed. However, about 1 week before he disappeared, Andrew began walking home from school, rather than taking the bus. Some have suggested this indicates he was being groomed, but there's no evidence of that. What sticks out to me most is this. If you're able to get a kid to stop taking the bus and start walking a route every day that allows you to pick him up in a car and not be seen, then why wouldn't you take him under those circumstances? Or, if he was meeting you in London, why not just drive him there after picking him up on his route walking home from school? The insertion of the train to London is senseless in that narrative. Beyond that, we have not one sighting of Andrew being approached by an adult on his way home from school. Undoubtedly, there are others along that route who attend the same school, and nobody reports a creep of any kind. So in my opinion, he was not being groomed by a pedophile prior to that day. What likely happened is that he met one inadvertently in London when he got there. Now, Andrew still took the bus to school in the morning, but had begun walking home in the afternoon. This walk is said to have been in excess of 4 miles and took about 1 hour and 20 minutes to complete. That's a long walk home from school. Logistically, it doesn't make much sense to spend that much time walking home every day, unless, of course, it's for the purpose of exercise. So, is it possible he was being groomed, and that the person was picking him up in a car spending an hour with him and dropping him off, which would allow him to get home in the 1 hour and 20 minute time frame I mentioned and keep appearances as though he walked. Sure, but again, no matter how we slice it, there's no evidence of grooming, and if this person was doing that and getting away with it unseen by others, what's the point of putting the kid on a train to London? He's more than willing to get in your car. You don't need to go to London, where they have an outrageous amount of security cameras that would undoubtedly identify you. We don't have evidence Andrew was lured to London by anything but his own desires. But the fact that he stops taking the bus is significant. Let's examine what it might mean. A school bus is a social setting. It's full of peers. So what does Andrew do? He extracts himself from it in favor of being alone. He's becoming more withdrawn than he already has been in the past. So, why is he withdrawing like this? Something is obviously bothering him. It's clear he's trying to get away from it. And if we combine that notion of getting away from the kids on the bus with the fact he doesn't socialize with other kids outside of school, it's apparent the thing from which he's withdrawing is his peers. He doesn't feel comfortable socializing. And if it's happening at age 14, to an extent he's isolating himself during a time in which he's supposed to start blossoming, so to speak, the answer is likely his sexuality. He's avoiding his own sexuality and the social implications attached to it. Why would such a thing happen in that manner? Probably for the reasons that his classmates suggested. He's likely gay. If his friends at school are all starting to become interested in girls, to the point they're pursuing them and going on dates or taking them to dances, then the same will be expected of Andrew. If he's in a group of immature teen guys talking about how hot the pretty girls are, he'll be expected to participate. If a girl becomes interested in him, reciprocation would often be an appropriate response. At age 14, telling your friends and or your family you're gay is truly daunting. For an introvert, it's even much worse. By extension of that, anything you do that allows you to live a lifestyle conducive to your sexuality is going to reveal your secret. And again, Andrew is a noted introvert. So what's easiest for him to do is run, hide, and remain in isolation. Introverts can survive there, but that isn't going to make him happy. At some point, the desire for authenticity, which also plagues the introvert, is going to come calling. And if he doesn't want to risk being detected for who he is, at home, or even at school, then what he's going to do is find the most relevant place to exploring his intended plight, but it must be in a location where he can blend into the crowd and remain anonymous, protecting his secret. It's Andrew dipping his toes in the water, learning who he really is. His rage that you see exuded with his heavy metal t-shirts and black clothing is comprised of the catch-22 within which he finds himself existing. He can't reconcile the fact that he has desires contrary to what might be acceptable at home and in school. And nothing in this world hurts more than that which we can't change. We come to learn the only way to deal with it is to change what we can. And what that idea amounts to is this: how we react to adverse circumstances. Andrew reaches peak isolation in the week leading up to his disappearance. But it isn't going to work. You can't run and hide from who you are and also be happy. That type of a situation has an endgame. The day comes you have to look in the mirror and love yourself despite what you can't change. So the idea is that you change your reaction to it. And I think that's what Andrew was in the process of attempting. Now, think about this. Why wouldn't Andrew just tell his family and friends? More specifically, what is the core idea upon which his decision to tell them or not hinges? The answer is trust. He believes he can't trust them to love and accept him once his secret has been divulged. And why? If his parents aren't gay and his friends at school aren't gay, then what he fears is that they can't do one thing: sympathize. And that lack of sympathy extends into something more important, which is empathy. Telling them his secret could blow up in his face. It happens often. And so, if you can't find sympathy and trust with someone you know, where do you look to garner understanding? You go looking for somebody like you. Somebody who is either going through or has been through the same thing. And if you need to keep that plight a secret, where is the safest place to journey? Somewhere you'll blend in. And if you live in England, London is truly that place. At the heart of all teen angst is the idea that you can't be who you really are because the circumstances at home don't allow it. You want to break free from that. And if who you want to be potentially conflicts with the beliefs of those who surround you on a regular basis, causing fear of being shunned, or even anything similar, then it's very likely you'll make your attempt to break free in total silence. I think this is pretty simple. I believe Andrew was gay and was becoming fed up with running from it and remaining in isolation to satisfy his need to hide it. I think he wanted a compromise, one in which he could explore himself and who he was becoming while keeping that exploration secret from those close to him. Undoubtedly, Andrew's absence from the school bus on the ride home in the week leading up to his disappearance could be chalked up to him getting away from it all and contemplating his life. It sure as hell didn't make any sense logistically, and he didn't even need the exercise. He was skinny. So I'm sure the London idea arose from that. When we seek answers to things or need to simply think, we often go for a walk. Nature, even in urban environments, communicates intuitively with us during such times. So look at what Andrew does. He goes for the walk home. He goes for the walk in London. Something is bothering him. It's weighing on him. Anyhow, let's go through the events of the morning of the disappearance and see what we can gather from them. Andrew's mother said he was reluctant to get out of bed that morning and required a couple of nudges to finally get up, which was unusual for him. She claims he seemed unwilling. Now, some have suggested this means he was up late talking to a groomer on some sort of device that he hid from his parents. But again, there's no evidence of that. What's more likely is that he just didn't want to go to school. And if you had been isolated and were becoming more withdrawn from your classmates in the previous week, to the point you were avoiding the bus to walk 4 miles instead to allow yourself to be alone just to think, then it stands to reason you feel like you need a break from it. I think he woke up that morning and said, "Fuck this, I'm not going to school today." I'm not sure I see any type of grand scheme attached to this trip. He wakes up, doesn't feel like getting up to go to school, and decides to skip his classes. Kids do that all the time. I don't think it was different for Andrew. I think he just wanted to get away, and for reasons I mentioned. So Andrew wakes up around 8 a.m. and gets ready for school, at which point he leaves home wearing his uniform. He would normally catch the bus to school at this time, but instead, Andrew goes to a park down the street, where he waits until his family members have left the house to go about their days. During this time, a neighbor spots Andrew seated on a bench, and he's also seen on video surveillance captured by one of the neighboring homes, which shows him going back to the Gosden residence. Now, we can't account for everything he did while there, or even all the items he might have had in his possession. But we know this. Andrew removes his uniform, placing it in the washing machine, and leaves the blazer hanging over the back of a chair in his bedroom. he gets a backpack, or more likely a knapsack, in which he places his PSP, or portable PlayStation, but he doesn't bring the charger. Now, this is an interesting development. We don't know if he failed to bring the charger because he forgot, or if it was intentional. Either way, it's interesting to me because the battery life on a PSP lasts between 2 and 2.5 hours, and the train ride he takes that morning is approximately 2 hours. More on that in a minute. He also didn't take a change of clothes, or even extra clothing in case of cold weather. To be honest, when I was 14, I went everywhere like that, without a thought or care for what the weather might be like when the sun went down. I just wore a t-shirt. If it was sunny and warm, I went out dressed for those conditions. Anyhow, Andrew also takes his wallet and keys, but leaves behind about 100 pounds he has in his room. At this point, he goes to an ATM and withdraws cash, a transaction for which there's much controversy over the implied meaning. Andrew has 214 pounds in his account, and the machine only dispenses in 20-pound increments. So Andrew withdraws 200 pounds, the entirety of what he can take. Some have suggested this insinuates he had no plans of returning, but let's note that the amount in question isn't exactly a fortune. It's not like he's emptying a flush bank account. This kid is broke, and broke people empty their bank accounts on a regular basis. If he's going to London, having a few extra pounds on hand to cover unforeseen expenses is a great idea. He might not even know exactly what he's going to do. But either way, I don't find this too suspicious. It's a relatively small, if not normal, amount of cash that you might need to carry in order to safely accommodate the trip. Had Andrew planned to leave and never return, he'd have naturally taken the cash on hand in his bedroom. But he doesn't. What's likely is that he expected to need more than 100 pounds and simply decided to get it all in one transaction from the machine. If he happened to lose his card later, or even get robbed, he would still have access to the money in his bedroom when he returned home. Now, this is where the PSP battery life comes back into play. Andrew goes to Doncaster Railway Station and purchases the ticket to London. Of course, you might expect he'd get a round-trip ticket, but he doesn't. Andrew insists upon one way. The clerk goes on to remind him that adding the return trip costs just a pound more than purchasing only the departing trip, making it nearly impossible to pass up unless you know for certain that you aren't coming back. But Andrew, even after the clarification, simply purchases the one-way ticket. There's no return trip. Think about that. Even with the clarification, someone described as a math whiz, even possibly a genius, is unwilling to pay one extra pound for the return trip. He must be really sure of himself. Now, combine that with the length of the PSP battery life, which matches the length of the single train trip. He didn't bring the charger. So it's almost like he intentionally didn't bring the charger because he knew he only needed enough battery life for the way to London. In that light, this starts to seem like it could be suicide. No changes of clothes, or even a jacket. No return ticket, not even for the insignificant cost of a pound. He empties the bank account. He deceives his parents in a way that they're obviously going to find out. He tells no one of his plan. It's almost like he just needed to get away, and it didn't matter after that. He shows signs of withdrawal and isolation leading up to the event. So, was this suicide? It does look as though Andrew could have perpetrated such an act against himself and planned it to happen in secrecy, away from his family. But we just don't know. However, we can say this. It's more likely he'd be found if the result was suicide. He can control the spot in which he commits the act in terms of discretion, but can't control the aftermath. To the contrary, a predator can control those circumstances in the context of murder. He can take actions after the death to make the body simply disappear. And that's what we have. Andrew is never seen again. So, I just don't feel like there's enough evidence to suggest the kid committed suicide. What I see is a tragedy that emotionally reflects his desires. He went looking for someone who understands him, someone he could finally trust with his secret, and found that in the form of a sexual predator, a pedophile who took his life and disposed of him. Think of the reality. Andrew is alone, far from home, and has told nobody of his intentions or location. Those elements combine to make a bitter cocktail that offers a stark probability. So, Andrew could have killed himself, but what's more likely, in my mind, is that the vampire got him. Now again, Andrew was seen on surveillance leaving King's Cross Station shortly after 11 a.m., but that's the last time his whereabouts are known. He just vanishes. Several witnesses claim to have seen him nearby, and one says he was at a local Pizza Hut eating early that afternoon around 1 p.m. or perhaps shortly thereafter. But nobody can confirm where he went or what he was doing. Police neglected to try to assemble security footage from multiple locations near the train station to try to string together a narrative, and by the time the sentiment was suggested to do so, much of the video had been wiped clean already. So we don't know how Andrew proceeded. It's speculated he might have been intending to go to a concert that evening, but there's no evidence he did that or even made plans for such a thing. To be honest, I think this kid just needed to get away. I'm not sure he knew exactly what he was going to do. He was hurting, and to a certain extent, snapped. I don't think he had some sort of overarching plan. He just went, in the same way that he needed to get the hell off the bus, he needed to get away from school for a day. Sometimes we have to get away from it all, and if we can do it without telling a soul where we went, or why, we indulge that level of privacy. I see that here. I think this was the first time in Andrew's sheltered, isolated life where he just truly needed to break free, to step away and breathe for a moment, to clear his head. He didn't have many options for doing that. Taking the train to London is a natural choice. It's adventurous, but still practical. The world would be at his fingertips, but home still just a train ride away. More than anything, I think the lack of return ticket is symbolic. He doesn't want to go back to that place in life. He was stifled. His physical refusal of the ticket, based upon emotional values, says this trip is him boiling over. It's the physical manifestation of an emotional issue. He wanted to transcend those emotions physically in a way that he was not able to do at home. But that safety he seeks in the anonymity of the city is also where the greatest danger lurks. And why? Predators know kids like him when they see them. Andrew isn't unique. We all go looking for something, and sometimes the tragedy is finding it. He could have paid that extra pound to get the return ticket, even if he planned to kill himself. But he fought it, even upon clarification from the seller. He didn't want it. If you're about to die, then why the hell would you care about spending an extra pound on a train ticket or even not using it? One could say buying the return portion of the ticket gave him permission to back out. But he could do that regardless. If you're committing suicide, you always have an ability to change your mind right up to the moment of action. For me, what's really telling in this situation is the Pizza Hut sighting. This is at least 2 hours after Andrew gets off the train, but he's still within a mile of the station. And what else is noticed about this circumstance? The kid is eating alone. He hasn't gone far and doesn't seem to have done much in the first few hours. What it says is that he didn't have a plan. He basically just went to London on a whim. And if you have no plans and are just hanging out, but have come here looking for something, then that thing is probably going to find you instead. But not in a good way. I think Andrew hung around the city alone and looking like a billboard advertisement for a pedophile until someone finally approached him. Put yourself in his shoes as a 14-year-old boy. Here's how life works. Let's say you're at the school dance. If you find the courage to approach someone you like and ask that person to dance, which results in a yes, that interaction becomes about getting what you wanted. The other person, by default of your desires, might also get what they want vicariously, but if you approach and ask, you either get what you want or not. Either way, it's about your actions and your desires. By being the aggressor, you have greater control over the design of the narrative. You become dominant while the other person is submissive. On the other hand, if you just sit around waiting and hoping for someone to ask you to dance, not only are you unable to control who approaches, you also don't know if the person has ulterior motives. And so you play this game from a position of ignorance related not only to the other person's desires, but also their identity. We don't get to choose who approaches us, but we do get to choose who we approach. And why? Predators approach. Prey is approached. It's nature's design. So, we have a situation where an introverted, baby-faced 14-year-old male who's having difficulty coming to terms with his sexuality and doesn't know how to talk to, aka approach others, in that context, and is waiting for someone to notice him. That's what Andrew has decided to do. He's going to be a wallflower at the dance and wait to get approached because he's a shy introvert. He'll just put up a sign. But look where he's doing it. In a major city during a time when other kids his age aren't around. So, who's the most likely type of person to recognize his plight? A pedophile. And what do they offer by being older? Experience. And what does that yield? Understanding. And what does Andrew want more than anything? Acceptance. He wants to find himself and others like him in order to be happy. We all do. And sometimes we decide to be a wallflower instead of the aggressor. And why? Because we're afraid. We don't want to get hurt. So what negates that fear? Trust. We have to trust others to let them inside. We have to be vulnerable. That allows them to approach. I think it's this simple. Andrew was isolated and lonely. At first, he used that as a coping mechanism, and it seemed reasonable because he's an introvert who likes to spend time alone. But over time, he developed a feeling of being trapped. His isolation at home, without friends, was something he believed would work by way of denial there was a problem. But it became a prison, and so, while we seem so baffled about why he didn't purchase a return ticket for the train, even though it only cost £1, what we're missing in our ignorance is the flip side of that. For the tiny cost of £1, Andrew got to say, "Fuck this, I'm not going back." Even if it wasn't true. That's how he felt emotionally. He took a physical action to complement an emotional idea because his pain and suffering were beginning to manifest in the material world. He was taking a train ride away from his problems and toward a perceived solution. That's why he refused to return ticket. He wasn't going to return to that place emotionally. But without the courage to be the aggressor at the dance, someone was going to approach him instead. Unfortunately, he chose a place where pedophiles can see kids like this while wearing a blindfold. It's too easy. Because most of them have been that person. In the absence of a complete physical narrative in this case, I do see its emotional counterpart. And what it says is that Andrew Gosden went to the dance hoping to be approached by someone who finally, for once in his life, would understand him without being told what the problem was. We all want that. But for the most part, it's just a fantasy. If you're hurt, alone, and waiting to be approached, nature dictates your prey. That isn't a method for saving yourself. It's a billboard advertising your weakness. I think this kid cut school, and I'm not sure he knew exactly what he was going to do, aside from getting away from it all, so to speak. He had family in London, and his parents had even offered him the opportunity to stay at his grandmother's house over the previous summer before school started. But he refused to go that route. I don't think moving in with Grandma was going to do anything to offer him freedom and social acceptance in a manner conducive to his desires at the time. Of course, it's pretty clear that if Andrew did go back home that day, he would have gotten in trouble. His parents would want to know why such a good student went off the rails and cut school without their permission, even to the point of deceiving them. It's totally out of character for him. And I think that's the point. Andrew didn't know how to generate a discussion with his parents about who he really was. He was afraid to act, and in the absence of doing so, knew that acting out would be his next best option. If he does something like this, obviously, his parents are going to be mad. But more importantly, they're going to want to know why he did it. And if nothing else, that opens the door to a conversation that leads in the direction of what he truly needs to divulge. But as it stood, he kept quiet, and they didn't know anything was wrong. I just don't think Andrew had the courage or maturity to provoke a discussion about his emotional suffering and was simply attempting, in lieu of that, to cry out for help. For me, this is definitely the physical manifestation of an emotional issue. He hit his threshold for emotional suffering and made a physical break in the absence of being able to transcend the issue by rational means. His parents would be able to see that billboard, even if they couldn't read what it advertised. And that might prompt the start of talks leading to the truth that he'd been hiding. Unfortunately, I think somebody else got to him first. Someone offering him understanding in his vulnerable state, which led to trusting the wrong person. Nothing in Andrew's home suggested he was leaving and not coming back. He left behind money and all of his clothes, but the purchase of a one-way ticket totally contradicts that. That contradiction says his refusal to return to this life was an emotional refusal and not practical in any way. He knew he'd return. The contradiction also says it was the physical manifestation of an emotional problem. If he wanted to leave and not come back, the physical circumstances would support that. But they don't. Andrew was running from the things in his head. We've all done it. But the particular brand of issue he was running from, and the corresponding understanding he sought because of it, made him a target for sexual predators. Here's the point of what he's doing. Andrew wants his parents to be worried about him. He wants them to pry, to ask questions, to get to the root of the issue. Being a genius who gets excellent grades and maintains perfect attendance is not the way to do that. That's going to please them and make them not worry at all, if anything. Andrew needs a way to say something's wrong. They can't see it. His desire for them to go looking for him equates emotionally to him wanting them to discover who he really is. He wants them to go searching and to learn the truth about him. When they have this collision with his circumstances and the dust settles, the truth should become more and more apparent as the clouds recede and the sun shines through. Here's what the parents will ask themselves. Why? Why did Andrew do this? Over time, and one way or another, asking that question will afford its answer. And then the truth will be known. And here's why it played out like this. Andrew's external want conflicts with his internal need. Andrew wants to get away from his life of isolation by taking off to London, but what he needs is to approach his parents about the issue at hand and lay his cards on the table in order to know if he'll be accepted for what he is. Instead of approaching them, he makes himself prey, and they're going to be forced to chase him down, to hunt for his location, and find out what went wrong. Notice he could have been the aggressor, and made the approach, but he was afraid. So he found himself in a situation where he made himself prey in order to be chased. And clearly, no matter what might have transpired, the effort ends badly. He gets what he wants, in all the wrong ways. Think of when you have a small child who disappears in the house, and you panic. You know something is wrong, so you go looking for the kid, and finally find her hiding in the corner of a closet, crying. And you can't imagine why she'd be there, or why she made you go searching all over for her. But the truth is always this. We want to be understood. And we don't usually know how to articulate that. So what is the first thing you say to a kid like that, because you want to make things right again? You ask what's wrong. And what type of response do you get? The kid usually says nothing is wrong, or worse, remains silent and won't tell you. In fact, this isn't exclusive to kids. Your spouse might do the same thing. They want you to figure out what's wrong because being understood is the most important emotional goal. As children, and even as adults, we often can't articulate that desire when afraid. And what is most often going to cause that type of fear is revealing your secrets, things that other people don't know. And why? Your secrets are where you're most vulnerable. You want to protect them at all costs. So it's common to force others to take on a predatory role in order to get access to those things. And the key element in allowing such access is simply this: trust. Predators don't have to trust potential prey. But potential prey, if it wishes to allow a predator to approach, must be able to incur risk related to that endeavor. And what is the thing that allows us the necessary courage to undergo risk? Again, it's trust. We must trust other people in order to let them inside. Acting as prey eases that process. We run away and then force them to come looking for us, whether we're the kid crying in the closet, the ex with a broken heart, or Andrew Gosden riding a train. We have only two types of creatures in the wild, and the same goes for society: predator and prey. If you present yourself as prey in the presence of predators, risk escalates, as does vulnerability. But the one thing for which human prey will allow compromise in this logic, in an instance where animals never would, is trust. People often extend each other trust. And because of that, the human predator is equipped with deceptive powers conducive to manipulating the truth of his approach. In the wild, you run and hide, or you're dead. Their lives are black and white. But human interaction is not black and white. Rather, it's decidedly gray. And that's because we create technology. We must have a greater threshold for detection. The animals are not going to evolve past their current form, more or less. But humans are going to produce abundant technology related to detecting one thing. Truth. Which means that lies are not necessary in the wild. It's simply kill or be killed. But in society, lies, deception, and criminality are the backbone of innovation. And at its core, that's the basis for what I believe happened to Andrew Gosden. He was not equipped to navigate the lies and deception that clouded his judgment. Therefore, he succumbed to a predator whose skills were superior to his own. And what is the one quality for which Andrew failed and the predator succeeded? Detection. More specifically, detection of what? Truth. Andrew was outmatched, naive, too willing to extend his trust. Most kids are like that due to immaturity. It's the reason we don't let them wander through society alone. They aren't ready. Now, think back to a moment ago when I said Andrew desperately wanted his parents to come looking for him, that he was crying out for help because he'd lived in a situation where they thought everything was fine due to his academic success. Just consider that notion as I relay the following fact to you right now. When Andrew's parents got home after work, they never bothered to check if he was there. They assumed he was either in the basement playing Xbox or in his bedroom doing homework. That's how predictable Andrew was in his behavior. He didn't really do much outside of the house. He didn't go looking for trouble. He was a good kid, but I think the other thing we see is that he was isolated and lonely, no matter the degree to which his suffering was self-imposed. Kids like Andrew can easily cause their parents to slip into denial about the truth regarding the way they live. Yes, introverted people enjoy their own company, but not having friends outside of school at age 14 and avoiding the indulgence of social situations that might lead to romantic circumstances at some point down the line doesn't lead to happiness over the long term. Kids don't have careers. Yes, they have school, but social interaction constitutes a large percentage of their free time. So I think there were clues his parents could have noticed in his routine that would offer them insight into the fact that he was lonely. He was socially withdrawn. But again, as hard as it is for a teen to talk to his parents about such things, adults struggle with it from their perspective as well. Denying the problem isn't difficult when the kid isn't displaying outward signs of rebellion and/or mental illness. The good student who keeps to himself is the facade Andrew built, and it's what his parents chose to see. But underneath that superficial reality, the truth was lurking. Now, unfortunately, on this day, while the school called to notify the parents of Andrew's absence, the call was placed to the wrong number, and nobody answered. So instead of the school leaving a message for Andrew's parents, they remained ignorant he never made it to class. It wasn't until dinner was ready that night, and they called for him to come to the table, did they realize he was gone. Of course, if he fell into the hands of a sexual predator, it's already too late. And I believe that's the case here. Andrew was vulnerable and desperate. He wanted to be understood, to be heard, to find himself in the eyes of another. The reason we have friendship in society is because it's an extension of civility not afforded creatures in the wild. If two animals see each other out in the forest, there's an assessment of dominance in relation to survival. Who is predator and who is prey? That's the question being posed. But in society, we're able to modify that interaction to create a purgatory in which neither party is predator or prey. It's called friendship. It's a mutually beneficial exchange of ideas that endeavors to unearth and capitalize upon the commonalities of the two participants. It's reciprocal, benefiting neither in the context of predator and prey, rather as a peer. The point of this is that the human condition, which is essentially spawned from the ability to ponder the question of why, as it relates to our mortality, is lonely. In our own bodies and minds, we are alone in our plight, but surrounded by others. And since these others are universally constructed as we have been, meaning in terms of their humanity, and by extension, their mortality, we're often able to relate to one another's experience. No one can share your experience completely, not even a twin. But what you can do is seek others like you, because they'll afford you the greatest understanding possible in relation to your identity. But in order for these relationships to blossom, as intended, both parties have to approach that purgatory of civility in the middle with authentic intentions. If you say you come as a friend, then you must abandon the notion of predator and prey. Yet, the pedophile pretends to offer the purgatory of friendship while he's truly the predator, preparing to pounce on the prey. And how does he find his victims? People who build facades to hide what they are easily able to find like-minded people. Yet here, one of them is using the facade to run and hide, while the other uses it to seek by hiding in plain sight. Sexual predators often hide in plain sight through associations with legitimate organizations or activities that put them in close proximity to kids. Anyhow, the prey runs and hides. The predator seeks. And people who play the same types of games often find themselves seated at the same table, involved in doing just that. It isn't a coincidence, because this is true. Loneliness is what brings them together. They're suffering the same problem, essentially. And what the predator wants is the prey to let down its guard or facade while maintaining his own for the purpose of deception until the moment he attacks. But if you look at the rules of nature, the prey can't abandon the facade if it wants to survive. Thankfully, nature doesn't have trust, but society does. A shark can't convince a blowfish to refrain from expanding because he wants to be friends. But a pedophile can convince Andrew Gosden to lower his emotional facade. And if Andrew lets him inside to view the loneliness and suffering, the kid will fall prey. In the interaction between pedophile and prey, the child plays by the rules of society, but falls victim to a game being played in society by the rules of nature. Just think of Andrew walking the city streets, surrounded by people, but still utterly alone, hoping, waiting for something to happen, for somebody to come along. We've all been there. Maybe not on the streets of London, but in that place in our hearts. And suddenly, out of nowhere, the person finds him. Someone who understands. It's exciting. It's new. It's magic. And that's the thing that truly hurts. It's not always real. Sometimes it is just a magic show, and a predator lies in wait. I want to offer some words from John Steinbeck that I think encapsulate the feeling we have. Quote, "We are lonesome animals. We spend all our life trying to be less lonesome. One of our ancient methods is to tell a story, begging the listener to say and to feel, yes, that's the way it is, or at least that's the way I feel it. You're not as alone as you thought." End quote. And I think we're all seeking that. Every moment of every day, for as long as we live, we want to find similar people to be part of our story, to share in our truth. But what one must always recognize is that even the finest stories are often fiction. I think that's what happened to Andrew Gosden. He wanted to believe it was magic. And tragically, it was. So could he have run away, never to return? Sure. Could he have killed himself? That's also a possibility. He could have even fallen in the river while drunk after attending a concert that night. But nobody's seen or heard from him since then. And when I look at his life and examine what it is he might have been searching for and why, it's apparent to me that his greatest vulnerability would be a pedophile. Andrew was highly intelligent, but far from street smart. He was a sheltered kid. For me, this situation is a matter of probability, and I think that favors the notion that Andrew fell victim to a sexual predator and his body was subsequently discarded. In some ways, I think we all feel like Andrew. Small, misunderstood, and lonely. But worse, unseen, even invisible. Sometimes we convince ourselves that nobody cares. And for some strange reason, it reminds me of another quote from Steinbeck's work. Quote, "I wonder how many people I've looked at all my life and never seen." End quote. And isn't it fitting that in a world where we feel so insignificant and alone, we soon crumble to dust and become the nothingness that haunted our mortal souls? In this life, our emotional plight is the same as our physical goal. We must fill the empty void with light. Not only in the universe, but even more importantly, within our hearts and minds. And that illumination is a product of your truth, and mine, everyone else's too. Without it, the world will go dark again, hope will be lost, and life ceases to exist. So we have to ponder, who am I? What will I become? Where do I go from here? And the answer to the riddle is that your questions are humanity's as well. You're just one brick in the wall of evolutionary architecture. And while that single brick may cause no structural compromise if missing, something isn't quite right in your absence. We can't do much with one brick, but together we have the power to build something truly special. And you don't get to be unique. You just get to be that single brick. But in the grand scheme of the plan, your life has profound meaning. Evolution doesn't want you to wait for happiness to arrive. It wants us all to build it. In the meantime, we need your help to decide what the future should look like. So let down your facade. Tell us how it hurts. And perhaps one day, the longing will subside. The sun shall rise, and the vampire will retreat to darkness forever. Until then, continue to dream with your eyes open. Avoid the seduction of lies, and keep forging a future that seeks a better world than the one in which you live. If we do that, we'll always have the promise of tomorrow. And isn't that the point? The best movies and books make us desperate to know exactly one thing. What happens next? That's all that matters. So I ask you, here and now, in this brief moment your star shines above, for all to see, which story will you write?